ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good evening and welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, an inquest into the Weeyambilla ambush that killed two police officers and a local resident finds the people responsible were delusional and intent on killing. Also, the Northern Territory gets ready for Tropical Cyclone Fina, and we'll meet the teetotal grandmother who decided to buy a Queensland country pub.
Behind the bar, that's my comfort zone. I can talk to anybody. Now that I know what sort of drinks they are, I used to have to ask people what colour can it was, or I had no idea.
First this evening, a Queensland coroner has found the fatal ambush of police officers at Weeyambilla in 2022 was triggered by the killer's shared psychotic disorder, and that while the police were adequately trained and resourced on the day, they were no match for the surprise attack that awaited them. Officers Rachel McCrow and Matthew Arnold were killed at a remote property near the town, about 4.5 hours' drive northwest of Brisbane. Neighbour Alan Dare was also killed. The inquest heard evidence that the crime could be classified as an act of fundamentalist Christian terrorism, but the coroner didn't agree, ruling it wasn't an act of terrorism under the current definitions. Rachel Mealy reports.
On a December day in 2022, four police officers arrived at a property in Weeyambilla, northwest of Brisbane, to follow up a warrant. They'd been sent from two different stations and introduced themselves as they walked up the driveway.
She's our newest first year.
Minutes later, two of the officers had been shot dead.
Matt's not moving, Rachel's not moving now.
Constables Rachel McCrow and Matthew Arnold were killed by brothers Gareth and Nathaniel Train, who were armed with rifles and hiding in the bushes on their property. The body camera worn by a third officer, Randall Kirk, documents the moment he called his officer in charge back at the station.
Have you got trees behind you? Have you got trees back
in the car? Yeah, maybe.
Mate, do they know where you are?
Yes, they do.
Mate, can you, obviously scramble from tree to tree to try and retreat out of there?
I'll try.
Are you able to try and do that?
I can try.
Randall Kirk was shot in the hip but managed to escape. Today, 3 years on from those events, Queensland coroner Terry Ryan found Nathaniel and Gareth Train and Gareth's wife Stacey, who were all later killed in a shootout, were suffering from a shared delusional disorder and were intent on killing. Their neighbour Alan Dare was also killed when he saw smoke coming from the property and came to investigate. The mother of slain police officer Rachel McCrow spoke on behalf of her family and Matthew Arnold's.
We thank the coroner for his work. Like us, he was forced to watch the harrowing videos and listen to every disgusting and disturbing detail during the five-week inquest.
The coroner found the Trains were psychotically unwell. He found there was a, quote, end of times religious theme which became central to their beliefs. But he said it wasn't possible for him to conclude that the crime was an act of terrorism. The coroner found the police officers were adequately trained and resourced on that day and said it was difficult to see how anyone would have been equipped to contend with the ambush they encountered. Judy McCrow says more should be done to prevent another tragedy.
From the outset, we've stressed any coronial recommendation must prevent tragedy like this happening again. And we are initially disappointed with the coronial recommendations. But we need time to read, process, and respond to the findings and ensure that as families, our concerns and issues that were raised during this process have been listened to and respected.
The coroner made recommendations relating to the training of 000 operators and for police to look into the use of drones in similar settings. He also recommended the Queensland Government give consideration to increasing funding for the Queensland Fixated Threat Assessment Centre and review the feasibility of introducing mandatory mental health assessments for weapons licence applications.
Rachel Mealy reporting. The Queensland coroner made no finding that the killers of the three Weambilla victims were so-called sovereign citizens. Apparently they didn't identify with that movement, even though they did oppose the government. Desi Freeman, the fugitive accused of shooting dead two Victorian police officers earlier this year, is a self-proclaimed sovereign citizen, though, someone who believes they don't have to obey government laws or the courts. The rise of that movement is leading to challenges for Australian courts. A major legal conference hosted by the top judges of Australia and New Zealand is considering the issue at the High Court in Canberra. Our High Court reporter Elizabeth Byrne has been following the proceedings today. Elizabeth, how big an issue is the sovereign citizen movement for Australian courts?
Well, it is a significant issue, and just how significant became clear today when the High Court conference began. A set of statistics and a study were released by the New South Wales Judicial Commission. It was a study of more than 600 judges and magistrates from all over Australia. And they said the thing that was causing them the most stress was having to deal with sovereign citizens and also unrepresented litigants. But it was the sovereign citizens themselves that seemed to provide the most stress. And they gave a few examples which show just how chaotic things can become. There was one example given about a magistrate who'd had to run and hide in the chambers, and the sovereign citizens had climbed up on the bench and were playing around with the keyboard while the court was supposed to be running, but obviously wasn't. And there was another example where a group of sovereign citizens unfurled a large flag in the court. Now, usually in any other court, you'd be thrown out, but this was a small regional court. She was clearly outnumbered, the magistrate and her staff. And so she looked up and looked at them and said, "That's a pretty flag," and moved on with things. So they're having to find all sorts of creative ways to get around this. But it was a very interesting survey. It also threw up complaints from judges and magistrates about a darker side to this, which is the threats that they sometimes receive and the rudeness and the disruption in the court when sovereign citizens have come in to deal with something.
So the courts are dealing with a lot of people, obviously, who just refuse to accept the authority of the court. So are lawyers and judges at this conference coming up with any sort of plan to deal with sovereign citizens in their courtrooms?
Well, thus far, not really, except to mention that it is becoming a significant issue and it is something that the courts will have to grapple with. And partly that's in the context of a failure in the system to provide for legal help. So there's the lack of access to justice, whether that's because you're a long way away from the major centres or you're poor or disadvantaged. But that is one topic that's being discussed. I did find it interesting that the survey included some material from overseas. For instance, in Canada, they've come up with a scheme where judges and magistrates will call long adjournments, and that disrupts the sovereign citizens because it takes them a while to get everybody in a group to come to court for a hearing. And another thing that they've done is to make some applications paper only, so there is no court appearance. So there's a few different things being tried here, I guess, and around the world.
Elizabeth, I understand artificial intelligence is another hot topic at the conference, and the High Court Chief Justice Stephen Gageler has sent out a warning today. What did he say?
He says the one thing, it's here to stay. It can't be avoided. The courts do have to grapple with it. But what his warning was about is that at the moment, the Australian judicial system is doing pretty well. The trust level is still at a healthy level. But we can't take that for granted, and particularly in the face of this escalation globally of declining trust, and also that coming in concert with the escalation of of the internet, social media and other forms of communication that we do have to heed the warnings of this changing global environment. And while we're all right for the moment, that might not last forever.
Our High Court reporter Elizabeth Byrne in Canberra. In the Northern Territory, residents are preparing for Tropical Cyclone Fina, which is expected to make landfall early tomorrow morning. Vulnerable Territorians in the Tiwi Islands and other remote spots are being flown to Darwin, and around the Territory, people are stocking up on essentials and tying down anything that might be swept away. Some areas are already experiencing gale force winds of up to 120 kilometres an hour and heavy rain. Kimberly Price filed this report.
Strong winds and heavy showers are hitting parts of the Northern Territory as residents prepare for Tropical Cyclone Fina. Nathan Fijo lives in Minjalang on Croker Island, east of the Tiwi Islands.
Pretty windy outside and it's been raining. The wind picked up sort of early hours this morning at about like 1 or 2 a.m.
The full brunt of this cyclone is yet to hit, and he says preparations are well underway.
Yeah, everyone's bunkering down at home. We're hoping the power's going to stay on. I mean, we're prepared. We've got our candles, we've got torches and stuff, so just praying that everything will be okay, yeah.
Cyclone Fina is expected to make landfall at 1 a.m. Northern Territory time on Saturday morning. Lynette DeSantis is the mayor of the Tiwi Islands Regional Council and believes up to 40 vulnerable people have been flown to Darwin to ensure they stay out of harm's way.
There was discussions over the last 2 days, and they were driving around yesterday, went around and asked people who they deemed vulnerable if they wanted to fly in, just so that they've got that medical care or attention that they would need, that they wouldn't be able to get here, you know, like if they have to get flown out for a major emergency or whatever. So we're evacuating those people who we think are really vulnerable.
In many of the warning areas, council buildings and schools have been made available for shelter. Simon Munkara lives in Wooroo Mayunga on Bathurst Island and can feel the storm brewing.
Yesterday we had a sunny day than the day before, but today it's a bit cloudy, black cloud around. Sunny on the left, but yeah, this is cloudy everywhere now, so I think it's building up.
Local police have told Simon Munkara to move to a safer location, and he's getting ready to tie down some of the large trees around his community.
We are going to move, I think, tomorrow to family house, because our house, a couple of houses, yeah, they've got a couple of trees, just big trees, and it's been safe for us.
He says everyone is trying to keep their spirits high.
Are we feeling all right? I need my daughter. I just keep asking this question. Me and my wife like, Mum, Dad, what is a cyclone, tornado, hurricane? Now we're pretty worried, especially for a lot of kids around the community and even oldies.
The Territory's Chief Minister, Leah Finocchiaro, says residents in the warning areas should find safe shelter before dark.
The worst of the conditions in Darwin are expected to be during the day tomorrow and into tomorrow evening. The winds will strengthen to 100 kilometres an hour with stronger gusts of 120 kilometres an hour in the warning area. Destructive wind gusts of 150 kilometres an hour could develop during this evening in the warning area as the system nears the coast.
Miriam Bradbury is from the Bureau of Meteorology.
So for a Category 2 system, we look for mean winds in the 90 to 120 kilometre an hour range with wind gusts from 125 to 165 kilometres an hour. Now, at the moment, the system, which has been analysed as a Category 1 system, is expected to strengthen again to Category 2 strength before it reaches the Coburg Peninsula.
As Cyclone Fina makes landfall, it could strengthen further.
Tropical Cyclone Fina is forecast to reach Category 3 strength, but not until later in the weekend when it's moving out over the Joseph Bonaparte Gulf.
Miriam Bradbury is a senior meteorologist at the Bureau. That report from Kimberly Price and Jack Hislop. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Well, the New South Wales Liberal Party has a new leader, with first-term MP Kelly Sloan being elected unopposed. Her elevation comes amid poor polling for the party, but she's declared she's ready to fight right through to the 2027 state election. Earlier this week, the Victorian Liberal Party also elected a female leader. So, along with Susan Lee at the helm at the federal level, are these latest changes a sign that the Liberal Party is finally heeding the message it needs more women in top roles? Isabel Massali prepared this report.
It's quite the crowd. I might have to get used to this.
As a first-term MP, Kelly Sloan is still a newcomer, but now she wants to make her own mark as leader of the New South Wales Liberals.
Well, I bring my own personal style to leadership. I'll be consultative. I'll try to remain myself, be authentic, listen to people. You know, we've got to do a better job of telling our story and reminding the people of New South Wales what we stand for.
She explains that's a focus on families, cost of living pressures, housing, health and transport. And with a state election 15 months away, she believes her party can deliver better results than Labor Premier Chris Minns.
He is a formidable opponent. He's a very good politician. He seems like a nice guy, but he's not delivering much. So we need to remind people of that, and we need to provide a vision for an ambitious plan for New South Wales.
Kelly Sloan was elected unopposed to the position after the resignation yesterday of former leader Mark Speakman, and it's been a quick rise through politics. She was elected in 2023 to the affluent seat of Vaucluse in Sydney's eastern suburbs, and she was the Shadow Health Minister. In her career before politics, she was a journalist for the ABC and Channel 9, and later led the organisation Life Education Australia. Politics lecturer Dr. Stuart Jackson from the University of Sydney says her previous roles will serve her well.
She has experience in fairly senior roles in terms of journalism, but also in terms of business and charity work. So she comes to the job, well, she has a certain pedigree as well. I should add, her partner is a former advisor to John Howard.
Dr. Jackson believes the rise of the teal independents in Australian politics could be playing a role in this move by the New South Wales Liberals.
I think in terms of leading moderates, she would be one of the best at this point in time. Vaucluse, of course, is a very well-heeled electorate, which has an independent federal MP and has had, you know, before Allegra Spender was Karen Phelps. So it actually, she's a good fit for electorate and probably a good fit for the New South Wales Liberals that currently hold seats in the city.
Dr. Jackson notes it's particularly interesting that women seem to be on the rise in the Liberal Party, with Susan Lee leading at a federal level and Jess Wilson taking charge this week as the Victorian opposition leader.
I think it's probably a good move on their part, but I do also think that there are particular politics playing out in the background, and that as we've seen certainly in the Labor Party at various times, women being put forward almost as a, you know, oh, well, we'll let a woman have a chance now until the boys can take control again. But maybe this will help cement the idea that Liberal women should be given a stronger voice.
Alex Smith is the state political editor of the Sydney Morning Herald. She says one of the biggest struggles for Kelly Sloan is overcoming the damage caused by the federal election. Net zero is shaping up to be one point of difference to the federal and New South Wales Liberals, with confirmation today that Kelly Sloan will continue to support the target.
She also has another significant hurdle, I think, in that she hasn't been around the party for all that long, which may in some ways help her, but it also means she probably isn't as used to dealing with, you know, the inner workings of the Liberal Party. And I think she is one of those strong female leaders in the parliamentary party. So that will be a plus for her and for the party, I think. But nonetheless, she still inherits all the problems that Mark Speakman had that he couldn't shake, and I think any leader will struggle with, and that is, you know, the brand damage.
Alex Smith from the Sydney Morning Herald. That report from Isabel Massali. The streaming platform Twitch is the latest to be caught up in the federal government's social media ban for under 16s. Twitch allows someone to live stream as they play video games and interact with viewers. It's been added to the banned list less than 3 weeks before the law comes into effect. Angus Randall prepared this report.
Wow! 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 Oh my God, it's me on Doomfest.
If your kids or grandkids have ever watched someone else play a video game, chances are it was on Twitch. Tama Lever is a professor of internet studies at Curtin University.
Twitch is synonymous with watching gaming, but also supporting other forms of live-streamed entertainment with especially a large, quite complex toolkit for audience interaction, both with the streamer and with each other.
For some of the biggest streamers, this audience can reach into the millions, all able to interact with both the streamer and each other.
Those million people are probably chatting to each other in different ways more than chatting with the streamer themselves. Whereas if you're a tiny community streamer with, say, 50 regular followers, then that community and that streamer probably interact with each other a hell of a lot more during the average stream.
Twitch is now the latest platform to be blocked under the federal government's social media ban for under 16s. While gaming platforms are exempt, eSafety Commissioner Julie Inman Grant ruled Twitch was primarily designed to encourage user interaction. The move has not been popular in Tama Lever's household.
My 13-year-old was quite delighted that Twitch wasn't on the list until this morning, and he did not look terribly pleased when I broke the news.
10 social media sites, including Facebook, YouTube and TikTok, will be banned for anyone aged under 16 from December 10. Communications Minister Annika Wells says Twitch is likely the final platform to be added.
Whilst we acknowledge this is a dynamic list because we want to have the ability to prevent harm if we see migratory patterns that are sending people to more harm, we don't anticipate that this list is going to change again between now and 10 December.
She says the onus is on platforms to ensure accounts are age verified, and young people still have plenty of outlets to chat to their friends.
Things like WhatsApp, group chat or Facebook Messenger, Messenger Kids are not captured by these laws. One thing that you can do ahead of 10 December is set up those chats with your friends so that come 10 December, you are ready to still communicate with your friends online across the school holidays.
Professor Tama Lever says young people will still want to express themselves online, even as platforms are blocked off.
I think one of the challenges with these platforms being added, especially being added at the last minute, is this sense that we're reducing the number of creative outlets and opportunities for young people. And I only hope that as we get better and better at shutting the gate, that we do think about how we're going to try and find new ways to give young people the opportunity to be creative and to express themselves online.
A Twitch spokesperson says no underage users will be permitted to sign up for a Twitch account as of December 10, and any Australian users under 16 will have their accounts deactivated in the month afterwards.
Angus Randall. Now to a story about someone who may be Australia's most unlikely publican. At just 142 centimetres tall, 71-year-old Barb Parkinson can barely see over the till. She doesn't drink and had never worked behind a bar. But 2 years ago, she and her daughter bought the Yandarin Hotel just up the road from Bundaberg in Queensland. Taylor Larson prepared this story.
Oh, don't tell me.
For almost 30 years, Barb Parkinson worked as a nurse, on her feet, caring for patients and meeting new people every day. But these days, her role is a little different.
Behind the bar, that's my comfort zone. I can talk to anybody. The other side of the bar, I feel like I'm right out of my comfort zone.
Moving to a small town and running a pub was not part of Barb's initial retirement plan. But these days, she's the proud co-owner of the Yandarin Hotel, a short drive north of Bundaberg along the Queensland coast. It's a story that began 2 years ago, thanks to a question from her daughter, Alicia.
She said to me, have you ever thought of retiring and owning a pub? And I said, no, why would I? I says, I don't even drink.
Not drinking alcohol made learning the ropes behind the bar an even greater challenge.
Now that I know what sort of drinks they are, I used to have to ask people what colour can it was, or I had no idea. I don't know some of the cans that have got alcohol in it. I'm not sure what sort of alcohol it is in.
And her nursing skills are still put to use even as a publican.
You find people come here with cuts and things like that. I've taken a few to hospital, but it's basically the same. You know, like nursing, you're meeting different people every day, different personalities.
But word soon spread and her caring nature made her a hit with visitors and locals.
She is just such a cute little ray of sunshine. And the second we met her, I felt like she was my granny as well, honestly.
I lost my mother a few years ago and granny is like a mother to me.
Ruth, you're having a whitefish now.
Okay. Talk about upselling.
She's come to love her small army of regulars.
They're like an extended family. I worry about them if I haven't seen them, and they need to tell me if they go on holiday so I don't fret or think something's happened.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Cheers. Cheers to Barb. That was Taylor Larson reporting from the Yandarin Hotel in Queensland. And that's PM for this week. I'm Samantha Donovan. Have a great weekend. Good night.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Ukraine would give up land, reduce the size of its army, and make Russian an official state language. Well, it would if it agreed to the Trump administration's reported plans to end the war. Today, Matthew Sussex, a visiting fellow at the ANU's Centre for European Studies, on the new peace proposal and how Putin is widening his aggression beyond Ukraine's borders. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.